ABC News World Headquarters in New York, this is World News Tonight with David Muir.
Good evening again, everyone, and it is great to have you with us here on History Made here in this country. The verdict coming in late this afternoon from Minneapolis. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin found guilty on all three charges in the death of George Floyd nearly a year ago. It was Memorial Day last year. The jury coming to a swift, unanimous decision after just 10 and a half hours of deliberation, intense anticipation across the country, waiting to hear, and then the verdict came in. The camera trained on Derek Chauvin's face as the judge read the decision: guilty of second-degree murder, guilty of third-degree murder, and guilty of second-degree manslaughter. Guilty on all three charges. The silence broken outside the courthouse, hundreds gathered there. Shouts of surprise, but also relief at George Floyd Square. That's right outside Cup Foods in South Minneapolis, where George Floyd died last Memorial Day. President Biden, as we've been reporting this afternoon, calling George Floyd's family, telling them, quote, nothing is going to make it all better, but at least now there is some justice. And this image tonight from Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, D.C. This is just across from the White House, a young black man falling to his knees in tears. We heard descriptions from our reporter, Rachel Scott, who was on the scene there. Within moments, Derek Chauvin placed in handcuffs and led away, potentially facing decades behind bars. And at this hour, the reaction, of course, coming in from across this country. What will it mean for the nation's reckoning on race, justice, and policing? ABC's Alex Perez leads us off tonight from Minneapolis.
Members of the jury, I will now read the verdicts.
The jury deliberating just 10 and a half hours, and with the nation watching, Judge Peter Cahill reading their unanimous verdict.
We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. Verdict count two. We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter as to count two, third-degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. Verdict count three. We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter as to count three, second-degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty.
The jury of seven women and five men, which included six people of color, stayed late last night and came in early this morning. They worked swiftly and didn't send out a single question during their deliberations.
Are these your verdicts? So say you one, so say you all.
Yes.
In Houston, George Floyd's family members, including his older brother, watching as the verdict was read.
Find the defendant guilty. Find the defendant guilty.
Here in Minneapolis, other family members erupting. And in George Floyd Square, near where he was murdered, jubilation. The prosecution built their case around that video seen around the world, the 9 minutes and 29 seconds that sparked a racial reckoning movement, telling jurors, believe your own eyes.
It's exactly what you knew. It's what you felt in your gut. It's what you now know in your heart. This wasn't policing. This was murder.
The teenager who shot that video, Darnella Frazier, taking the stand, testifying off camera. Like so many eyewitnesses, she's still haunted by what she saw.
When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad. I look at my brothers. I look at my cousins, my uncles, because they are all black. I look at how that could have been one of them. It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
Swear or affirm?
A dozen law enforcement witnesses, including the Minneapolis chief of police, testified against Derek Chauvin.
To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, it is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
The prosecution's medical experts were blunt.
A healthy person subjected to what Mr. Floyd was subjected to would have died. as a result of what he was subjected to.
Chauvin opting not to take the stand in his own defense.
I will invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege today.
His attorney calling just 7 witnesses to the prosecution's 38. They sought to convince jurors that George Floyd's heart disease and drug use led to his death, not Chauvin's knee on his neck.
Derek Chauvin did exactly what he had been trained to do over the course of his 19-year career. The use of force is not attractive, but it is a necessary component of policing.
But the jury was not convinced, and tonight we have their judgment. What Derek Chauvin did to George Floyd wasn't policing, it was murder. The former officer put in handcuffs himself as he was led out of court.
And so where do we go from here as far as Derek Chauvin and his fate? Let's bring in Alex Perez, who's been covering this case from the start and the trial there in Minneapolis. Alex, I understand Derek Chauvin will be sentenced in about 8 weeks now, and he faces up to 40 years behind bars based on that most serious of the charges?
Yeah, that's right, David. He could face up to 40 years behind bars. The judge will have a lot of discretion and can consider many factors when he imposes his sentence. Tonight, David, we're hearing from Darnella Frazier, that young woman who posted and shared that video that we've all seen. She tweeted tonight, George Floyd, we did it. Justice has been served. David?
Darnella Frazier reacting to the news today, and we remember her on the witness stand saying she has cried many a night wondering if she could have done more for George Floyd. Alex Perez leading us off tonight on this evening. Alex, thank you. And of course, there's already a strong reaction and moving reactions coming in from across this country. George Floyd's death sparked demonstrations and protests and conversations, including people from various races and backgrounds across this country, parents bringing their children out to these protests. And tonight, ABC's Lindsay Davis is in Minneapolis with what we're seeing so far.
Tonight, the crowd outside Cub Foods in Minneapolis erupting in cheers as they learned of Derek Chauvin's conviction in George Floyd's death. At the U.S. Capitol, members of the Congressional Black Caucus clasping hands as they listened to the verdict. The disturbing video of Chauvin with his knee on Floyd's neck as Floyd told officers he could not breathe stunned the world. The Memorial Day incident then inciting outrage with people from various races and backgrounds taking to the streets. In the nation's capital and across the country last summer, scenes of protesters face down in silence, remembering the 46-year-old father. The Black Lives Matter movement seeing a resurgence.
Black Lives Matter!
Black Lives Matter!
And from Los Angeles to Phoenix, Orlando to New York City, demonstrators demanding justice for Floyd, but also for other African Americans who've died in police custody. At the Brooklyn Memorial Service, his brother Terrence telling our David Muir his family appreciated the diversity seen among demonstrators.
When you looked out into that crowd and you saw that sea of faces, black, white, Asian American, Latino, what did you make of it?
I just knew my brother was proud. Because I know the whole Floyd family was proud of that. Because we all standing together. We all standing together for the cause of justice.
In September of last year, that intersection near where Floyd was arrested renamed George Floyd Square.
And so let's bring in Lindsay Davis tonight, our Sunday night anchor who's on the ground in Minneapolis. And Lindsay, George Floyd's death, we know, sparked a conversation across this country and a long overdue one. And you were saying as we were on the air with our breaking coverage earlier that the word that best describes perhaps what you witnessed there in Minneapolis is that people exhaled. And I gathered that happened in cities across this country and in small towns where we saw these protests and conversations started between police and people who live in those communities. And tonight, Ken Moten reporting that George Floyd's family hopes that this verdict is just the beginning of this next chapter.
That's right. You can still hear some celebratory cheers out in the streets now, but people are also ready to get to work as far as real change. Many members of the Black Caucus and Democrats are asking for legislation, specifically named George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. This is legislation that would combat misconduct in policing and particularly racial bias in policing. David.
Lindsay Davis with our coverage in Minneapolis tonight. Lindsay, thank you so much. Been with me for all of our coverage throughout this trial. I want to bring in our chief legal analyst, Dan Abrams, tonight. And Dan, before we get to the question, I just wanted to point out that this jury, the makeup of the jury, which is a headline in and of itself, we knew this going in, but perhaps now it will be even more significant part of this as we learn more from the jurors in the days and weeks ahead. The jury was made up of six white jurors, six people of color, four black jurors, and two people who identify as mixed race. So a very diverse jury deciding this. And we know that in those closing arguments in the last 24 hours, a prosecutor is going back to what they said on the very first day in that opening statement, that you can believe what you see, and that it would appear the jurors did.
Absolutely. That message resonated. Believe what you see. Believe your eyes. Use your common sense. Those were the basic arguments made by the prosecutors, which is the video tells the story. And I think when you point out about the diversity of the jurors, it wasn't just their racial diversity. There was a great diversity in terms of what they did for a living and how they viewed the world and how they viewed the protests, etc. And I think that this can instill a sense of confidence that this really was a jury of Americans coming together to reach this unanimous verdict on all of the charges in a relatively short period of time.
Dan Abrams with us tonight on this trial. Dan, thank you. And I want to go to our colleague now, former prosecutor Sonny Hostin, also an ABC News legal analyst. And Sonny, you were telling me right before we went on the air with news of the verdict that as a veteran prosecutor yourself, even you were surprised that this deliberation was relatively short. There were no questions from these jurors, no confusion over the charges. They were clear-eyed when it came to this decision that they've made.
This was highly unusual. I mean, it's always clear to prosecutors that a quick verdict, a fast verdict, really hints at an agreement. But in a case like this, with over 40 witnesses, with medical testimony, although there was this video that the world had seen, the defense, although didn't have a lot to work with, did a decent job with reasonable doubt. And so I was very surprised that there were no questions for readback of testimony, no questions for legal instruction, clarification. That is very, very odd, especially when it comes to convicting a police officer, because we know in this country, I think that many jurors are loath to convict police officers. Historically, think about it, since 2015, there have been about 15,000 police killings. And I would say that stats aren't very clear, but Chauvin is probably only the seventh police officer that has been convicted of murder. Those are the stats. That shows you how difficult it is to convict.
And we know the prosecution was aware of that, which is why in their closing argument, Sonny, they showed just the vast number of police witnesses on that one visual that they put before the jury. Several police witnesses, including the police chief who came forward and testified against Officer Chauvin, that was extraordinarily rare to witness during a trial. One other question for you. The defense worked throughout this trial and in their closing in talking about the bystanders, talking about them as a potential threat, but at the very least a distraction. And then the prosecution, in their final word, their rebuttal, they got up there and they said, the bystanders, they said, you've met most of the bystanders who were there that day. And they closed with the thought of that 9-year-old girl who witnessed the whole thing. And she was on the witness stand and she said she remembered when the paramedics arrived more than 9 minutes into that video and the paramedics had to say, get off of him.
That was one of the most effective rebuttals that I have ever seen, David. Putting the eyes of a 9-year-old up there for the world and for the jury to see, it was really, really remarkable. And this is what justice looks like. Justice is accountability.
Sonny Hostin and Dan Abrams, our legal analysts with us here tonight, our thanks to you both. We know that President Biden called the Floyd family moments after the verdict was read. We know we have a camera angle of part of that conversation. The phone call was made from the Oval Office, but here is the other side of that phone call in the hallways of that courthouse. Take a look.
Feeling better now. Nothing is going to make it all better, but at least God, now there's some justice. And, you know, I think a John is coming. My dad is going to change the world. He's going to start to change it now.
That's right.
Yes. Yes.
Amen. He's going to start to change it now.
Yes.
So You've been incredible. You're an incredible family. I wish I were there just with my arms around you.
President Biden calling George Floyd's family, and our chief White House correspondent, Cecilia Vega, is here. And Cecilia, we know this is a relationship that dates back to almost a year ago, right after this tragedy. The president, then former Vice President Joe Biden, we know now he's the president, obviously, but he reached out to that family very early on. He went down to Houston on the eve of the funeral, met with the family, and left a message, a video message played at that funeral. It is not something he has shied away from, the fact that he wholeheartedly supported this family and this conversation that the loss of their loved one spurred in America.
He has said all along, David, that he believes George Floyd was murdered and that he died in the hands of brutality. And he said in that phone call today that this verdict was justice. The family is hoping now for some recognition here in Washington. They want to see the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act passed. It has passed in the House, but it is stalled in the Senate. This would ban chokeholds. It would create a national registry for police misconduct. But Republicans, David, here in Washington, say that this bill would weaken law enforcement and potentially put officers at risk. So right now, this hope for movement is stalled.
Cecilia Vega reporting on late developments from the White House, that conversation the president had with the family. Cecilia, thank you. And we should note that we do expect to hear from President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris at some point this evening. If it happens during the broadcast, we will bring it to you. Our thanks to Cecilia and to our entire team covering this verdict all afternoon here on ABC. There is, of course, other news that we're following tonight and the concern growing when it comes to coronavirus here in the U.S., the demand for vaccines slowing down. Thousands of appointments apparently going ignored across the country, and they want to get the word out that there is available vaccine. This all comes after the CDC imposed that temporary pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Tonight, European regulators now supporting the one-shot vaccine as long as there is a warning that goes with it, saying that the benefits do outweigh the risks. The CDC saying it could lift the pause here. Later this week, we know there's going to be another meeting. What they're reluctant about, what we're learning tonight. Here's ABC's Marcus Moore.
Growing reports tonight that demand for vaccines is slowing down as thousands of appointments go unfilled across the country.
How critical is it that people get vaccinated?
It is absolutely critical. We are in a race against the virus and against time to reach herd immunity before this virus mutates into something that can defeat our vaccines.
This site in Dallas can do 12,000 vaccinations a day, but on some days they're doing as few as 4,000. 44% of the counties in this country are still battling high community spread of coronavirus, but many rural areas are seeing lower turnout for the vaccine.
Just like many other places across the United States, largely rural populations are just not coming out to get vaccinated.
And vaccine hesitancy is higher in underserved communities hit hardest by the virus.
I'm just waiting more or less to see what is going on, and then I can decide whether or not if I want to take it.
A recent poll revealing a political divide, too. 45% of Republicans said they do not plan to get a COVID-19 vaccine right now, compared to 27% of Americans overall.
All right.
Doctor and Republican Congressman Andy Harris giving shots in his home district in Maryland.
You should be getting the vaccine because the benefits outweigh the risks, and we need to make sure that we protect our most vulnerable people in the United States.
David, back to that news on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. While European officials are recommending a warning back here in the U.S., the CDC advisory panel is expected to meet again on Friday. David.
All right, Marcus Moore tonight with us as well. Thank you, Marcus.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you'd do with an extra hour in your day? Would you go for a run, take a nap, read a book, or maybe show up for a friend? We often find ourselves wishing for more time, but the real question is, time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? The key to squeezing that special thing into your schedule is knowing what's truly important to you and making it a priority. That's where therapy comes in. It's not just about dealing with problems, it's about finding what matters to you so you can do more of it. If you've tried therapy, you know how beneficial it can be. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It's a tool for learning positive coping skills, setting boundaries, and empowering yourself to be the best version of you. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. And the best part? You can switch therapists at any time at no additional charge. So whether it's finding that extra hour for yourself or embarking on a journey of self-discovery, therapy can be a game changer. Take the first step with BetterHelp. and make your mental health a priority. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/tonight to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/tonight.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Next tonight, hear the deadly supermarket shooting outside New York City. Police say an employee armed with a handgun opening fire in the store, a Stop and Shop in West Hempstead, Long Island. About 200 customers were inside the store at the time. The gunman, police say, bursting into a second floor office, killing the manager and wounding two employees. Police arresting Gabriel Wilson 2 miles away after an intense manhunt. There is no word on a motive tonight. Former Vice President Walter Mondale has died at the age of 93. Mondale is credited with transforming the role of vice president under President Jimmy Carter and then making history as a presidential candidate by choosing a woman as his running mate, Geraldine Ferraro. President Carter tonight calling him the best vice president in our country's history, and President Biden tonight saying it was Walter Mondale who defined the vice presidency as a full partnership. And an end note tonight, as a nation responds to the guilty verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the images outside the courthouse in Minneapolis, cheers of justice. In Washington, D.C., Allison Haywood hugging her mother as they heard. And London Williams from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, reacting. George Floyd's family tonight saying they hope a new chapter begins of conversation and unity in this country. Good night.